Yes, hello again, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave, a presentation of Evergreen Podcasts. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy, Flynn McClain. Flynn, so what's happening?
Well, not much, actually. We're just going to be talking about the 2008 leg of the Magic Tour. But I think you had you wanted to talk about Record Store Day, right?
Yeah, I'm a little disgruntled today. We're recording this. They just released the list of releases for the upcoming Record Store Day 2022, and you got U2 on there with the Celebration. Pearl Jam is releasing Live on Two Legs, which is their live album from 1998. The Who is releasing something. Bowie is releasing multiple releases. Grateful Dead. I checked the list, and once again, no Bruce. And it just seems to me like a missed opportunity. First of all, they're costing themselves money. I think I read, I'd have to go back to the list, Pearl Jam is doing like a 20,000 run of Live on Two Legs. It's free money, and I don't understand why Bruce is one of the few artists not taking advantage of Record Store Day. How cool would it be to have December 12th, 1975 as one example on vinyl, or Anaheim 2000, or even some of the earlier releases, Passaic?
Of course you would say Anaheim.
Well, that just happens to be one of the most recent releases.
I think that would be a very difficult one to do on vinyl, considering the five pack there. But I had the thought that they should release 9/1978 on vinyl and call it Piece de Resistance.
Well, just I go head to head. Also, someone brought that up today. Piece de Resistance, the official version.
There you go. Or Live in the Promised Land, or any of the famous of the 78 radio broadcast bootlegs. I was a teenage werewolf for. Live, I don't know, what's the Rock? I guess the Roxy really didn't have too much of a famous bootleg. But
it's just a little frustrating. U2, every Record Store Day has a release. Pearl Jam has been having them every Record Store Day. The Dead, of course. Bowie, The Who, The Doors regularly.
Well, let me ask a question here. Mm-hmm. How many of these are a previously unheard song or recording?
Some of it is very cool. The Who announced they're releasing today a 40th anniversary edition of It's Hard, and they're including a version of Eminence Front with Daltrey on the vocals, which I had never heard of before. And I actually went and Googled it because I was like, is this out there? And I guess like a snippet was released by some Who superfan site a couple of years ago, but otherwise it's never been heard before.
Okay, so would you say most of these releases are previously unheard or previously released on digital or in another format a long time ago?
I don't know fully. I mean, I think for each act, it's different. Take The Doors. They're doing an L.A. Woman LP set that is from their L.A. Woman box set, which is not otherwise available on vinyl, I don't believe. U2 has been repressing a lot of stuff from the early 80s and putting in some interesting stuff. The version of The Celebration, the U2 single that's going to be for Record Store Day, which was backed by Party Girl 40 years ago, has a live version of Party Girl from 2015, which has not been released before, and also an outtake of A Celebration that has not been released before. So I think every act is handling it differently, and nobody is suggesting that Bruce should be releasing Electric Nebraska for Record Store Day, although that would be super cool.
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
If you look at what The Dead is doing, every Record Store Day, The Dead release an entire show on vinyl. Bruce has got these shows already in the can, as we like to say. There's been how many archive releases? None of them have been released on vinyl, except if you include the first Hammersmith, which, of course, was not part of the archive series. But it just seems like they're leaving free money on the table. These bands are charging good money for these releases, and they are selling. So I just don't get it. But maybe they just don't plan far enough. Now, the Pearl Jam release is delayed until June. I believe that's a vinyl production problem. But it would just be so great to have Bruce participate with these other acts. And I don't know what would make that happen.
Well, see, what I was getting at was, as someone who doesn't have a record player, I have really no interest in the content on the actual vinyl. I would be much more interested if he released something we never heard before. I thought the Record Store Day release of American Beauty, I guess that was 14, I thought that was phenomenal. It was four songs we had never heard before. They were from the High Hopes sessions. And they may not have been four of the best songs he's ever done, but it was four songs we had never heard before. And that would definitely be more of interest to me.
I totally agree. And he did release some really cool stuff much earlier in the process for Record Store Day. It's really weird because as Record Store Day has just gotten so huge now, and it is massive.
See, maybe he was into it, you know, back when it was cool and indie, and now it's all mainstream. And he's like, no, I'm too cool for that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah,
because he's not Mr. Mainstream.
Yeah, it would be really cool to see him participate. And even I would probably buy a four platter version of I don't whatever show that they choose to release. But I guess it's just not going to happen this year.
It's just so funny because every time the list comes out, I'm always like, Bruce, is he on here? Is he on here? Nope, he's not on here. So
what song on Letter to You did he originally say was going to be like a Letter Store Day or a Letter Store Day, Record Store Day release? Was it Janie Needs a Shooter? They actually.
Oh, yes, he did say that. You're right. He did say that originally he was going to just put out Janie Needs a Shooter for Record Store Day, and he thought it was too special. And you can understand that because it wound up on an actual album. But as we know, there are hundreds of outtakes. There are 50 or 60 archive shows at this point. They certainly have the material. 70. Okay. They certainly had the material to put out. And it just happened that it was today that the list came out. So I was like, all right, I'm going to mention that. But it sort of is what it is. I mean,
as they say, yes.
We would buy it. Let's just say that if they put it out, we will buy it.
Definitely buy it. Anyway, Bruce was also he also talked to your guy Eddie Vedder for what, half an hour or the other day, and I got to admit, I still haven't seen it, so I'm going to ask you to give me the highlights.
Sure. It was a conversation about Ed's album Earthling, which I happen to really like, and the talk between them wasn't really 30 minutes long because it was interspersed with some of the songs. But I definitely thought it was interesting. Ed, as it relates to Bruce, talked about how he thought Letter to You was really a marvel. He was like, it was recorded in 7 days. And Bruce was like, no, it was recorded in four. And Ed was like, he couldn't conceive of it. And Bruce did like Ed's album. It sounded quite a bit. He specifically brought up the song The Haves, which is a love song that he liked. And it was just great to see.
I can imagine.
Ed is on tour now. It happens that they were supposed to be out here on the West Coast this week, and the shows are canceled due to COVID. Well, rescheduled, I should say. They're rescheduled because Josh Klinghoffer came down with COVID, one of Ed's band members in Chicago, and then it apparently spread, and they had to postpone two shows, which really goes to show, again, what these artists are facing with the touring and perhaps provide some insight into why Bruce just didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah, you had told me it's like a 2 week tour and
a month. It was a month, but they had 2 weeks into. They didn't even get 2 weeks before they had postponements.
And that's not exactly a big band, right? I mean, it's five guys on there.
You know, I really don't know off the top of my head. It's certainly not a huge band. It may be six people. I haven't seen them yet because the shows are postponed. So it goes to show, and Glenn Hansard, who is in the band and who's fabulous, he posted on Instagram yesterday that this was their touring process. Hotel, into the car, into the venue, end of show, into the car, back to the hotel, basically without interacting with anyone. Nobody allowed backstage, nothing. And still somehow COVID has entered the picture. So going back to our episode when we were talking about Bruce canceling the tour, and I even said to you, what happens in Amsterdam when Landau is sitting there and someone comes in and tells them Roy and Gary just tested positive and they can't go out on the stage? That actually happened to Ed, apparently, in Chicago, because Josh Klinghoffer played the first night. And then the next night, the second show, the show started. Josh was not on stage. And Ed ultimately said that Josh had COVID and couldn't make the show. I guess they elected, and they do have a total of four guitarists, including Ed, just to play the show without Josh, even though he was a major loss. But then after it spread, it made the other shows unplayable.
Yeah, so I guess one band member was expendable, but I mean, any more than that. And I don't consider anybody in the E Street band to be expendable at all. Like maybe, unfortunately, maybe Steven, because he's hasn't toured with them for most of 14. But still, you know, Gary or Roy or Max. That would be a big hole to fill. And
well, you certainly can't play a show without Max.
No, but even if you have their tech on backup, or if you fly in Jay or something, that's no longer the legendary E Street Band.
Oh, and it's interesting you mentioned that, because the War on Drugs had a show. I think it may have been even the same night as they were in Chicago as well. And their tour manager played bass for the entire show because their bassist, Dave Hartley, was out. I don't know if that was a COVID thing, but clearly it's a struggle right now. And Pete Townsend just talked about this in Rolling Stone, the issues with insurance and that they're basically being forced to also tour without interacting with anyone. Some of these acts have shows to make up, Pearl Jam, The Who, and other acts. Bruce, he would have had to go out. They were going to be on a fairly tight schedule in Europe, as far as we understand it. And the other thing is, if he had to make up shows, of course, they just can't cram shows in anymore because he needs more recovery time.
I think they made the right decision. And could they have done something more in the United States later on? Maybe, but they've already made that decision. And it's just time to look ahead to 23.
Yeah, I would have probably, if I was them, at least held out some hope for the United States because it wasn't starting until August, but perhaps that just wasn't enough shows for them to rev up the entire machine. It was going to be what, 12 or 14 shows in the United States because they were going to be stadium shows. Unfortunately, it's where we're at. I got a lot of shows coming up. I hope that they will not be impacted. Already I've had Ed's tour impacted. We certainly hope that everyone in the band and anyone part of Ed's crew who were sick are healthy and recovering. And fans in general are just going to have to deal with uncertainty. You could be in a venue, it appears right now, and find out that the show is postponed. This is touring in 2022.
And yet there are still acts announcing tours, but good luck to them.
Well, as I think we discussed back in January, certain acts have to tour. For one thing, some of them have shows that need to be made up. Those shows are all stacked up. And secondly, there are tours going on because artists are in desperate need of the financial aspect of touring. As we know, Bruce does not have to worry about that.
Yeah, Bruce is not in financial straits, to say the least.
Well, even now, when he did that Hall of Fame, when he did the Hall of Fame induction speech, and he said if he went crazy and blew all his money, I don't even think he couldn't blow all his money now if he tried.
That would take a while.
Yeah,
that would take a while. Get some gold plated leashes on some tigers. I think that's how it is in the God, what's her name? The Royal song. I forget her name.
Lord.
Come on. Lord. Yeah. Okay.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Anyway, let's move back to 2008.
So we're going to pick up on the Magic Tour beginning in Hartford, the first show of 2008. I was still on the West Coast at that point. You were at Hartford, right?
Yeah. Thought you would say something like 2008 began the same place 2007 began.
It did.
Yes. And so they came out and they it was actually a really strong set for oftentimes when after they're off for a few months and they just come back to get their road legs at the beginning of the next leg. A little shaky, a little rusty. You know, or a standard set, but this time they didn't have it. They came out strong, So Young and In Love with the tour debut. Also played Loose Ends and Janie, Don't You Lose Heart, which Bruce and Nils actually did a duet on, and which was really cool. And it was a strong set just from the get go. And I almost went home and said, "Oh, I got to go see more shows," but I held off. I already had tickets for like four or five more shows, and I think that worked quite well.
From there, they went through more cities in the Northeast. They also hit Hamilton and Montreal in Canada. They arrived, I believe both of us were at the Coliseum show in March, on March 10th, which wasn't a particularly remarkable show, but they were playing so well at that point. It was a very, very satisfying show.
Right. Well, one thing after that hot start in Hartford, playing the couple of playing tracks, they seem to kind of backtrack, so to speak, into mostly sticking with the usual standards. But then in Nassau Coliseum, they busted out Incident on 57th Street, and that was pretty damn cool.
We did skip over one thing that does bear mention, and that was on March 6th in Rochester, Rosalita was played off a sign request, which of course had reversed the antipathy he seemed to have towards signs from the reunion tour. And that set off a change in the tour that would reverberate for the rest of the year.
And the following year.
Yes.
That's a good call. Well, I mean, he had actually come to accept some of the signs at the end of the Rising tour. I remember at that wild Philly show, August 11th, 2003, he referenced "I'm Going Down" an Incident, thanks to those gorgeous, beautiful homemade signs. And so I think he kind of warmed up to them, and then he embraced them. They became basically a standard part of the show from, I don't know, I guess it kind of started slowly, but then you had the whole...
It was really during the summer that it really became a thing.
Yeah, especially when you listen to, or at some of the, I mean, the St. Louis show that we're going to spend half an hour talking about later. Where he's collecting signs, and he got Max playing the drum beat and for about two and a half minutes while he collects signs. So, and then of course in 2009 when he did Raise Your Hand in that while he collected signs. So yeah, from small things, big things one day come.
After the Coliseum, they moved on. They headed to the Midwest in Milwaukee. He debuted Streets of Fire, but it's the next show that we're really going to focus on right now. And that was the March 20th, 2008 show, which of course is an archive release. And
then we talked about it for like 20 minutes.
Yeah. We should probably just, it's a setup for the rest of the tour, I think, because obviously the emotional aspects of the evening, I think it's important that we focus on Danny's guest appearance here. And as we discussed at the time when the archive came out, he guested on Promised Land and Spirit in the Night and Sandy in the main set, and then more in the encores.
It was an emotional show. I think people were glad to see him. And if I remember correctly, he wasn't looking very good, but he was able to play for what, 9-10 songs. And it was a good send-off for him.
Yeah, it's so good that was able to happen. I think we discussed it on the show once before. Jason Federici, Danny's son, has talked about how Max and Becky Weinberg in particular went to the hospital to encourage Danny to get on the plane and go with them to Indianapolis. They must have known at that point that he was nearing the end. And it just, looking at it from afar, must have provided a sense of closure. As we talked about for the Boston show the last time, They're family, they're brothers, and I think that it must have been an incredibly powerful experience for them all, especially Danny, to have one last time all together.
Totally agree, and Bruce pulled out Sandy again for him, and that was a beautiful performance. They actually released it at the time, but later that year in that Magic Tour Highlights four song EP. And that was wonderful to see. And I think proceeds from that went to the Danny Fund.
And the next show was in Cincinnati.
Yeah, let's talk about this.
Yeah. It reverberated, obviously, Danny's guest appearance. Now, this is not a show I was at. I don't think you were in Cincinnati either, right?
I was not. It was a Saturday night, and I was tempted, checked out flights and such, but didn't pull any triggers.
This show was notable because I guess Bruce went through the entire set and the encores. The show didn't even hit 2 hours. And then maybe someone said something to him backstage because they were already starting to break down the stage, right?
That I don't know, but okay. Probably.
But after American Lamb, the show was totally over. And then they hustled back on stage and did a version of Kitty's Back, which was which made the show longer, still much shorter than most of the shows in this time period. But I think clearly the band must have just been in a different state of mind than they normally are playing these shows because what have taken place in Indianapolis.
Well, I remember hearing that they were, it seemed like Bruce was just like at a breakneck speed the whole show. And then you do have a couple short songs in there, Candy's Room, She's the One. But for the most part, it was a pretty standard set. I don't know what was going on, or maybe they had to get back for something on Sunday. I don't know. But it was definitely eyebrow raising at the time. But then they did come back Columbus a couple days later and put on a much stronger and longer show.
That show also had the only ever version of You'll Be Coming Down.
Yeah, that's actually, I would call that a nice little dark horse recording. It was really good bootleg came out of that show, and very excellent. I love that version of You'll Be Coming Down. It's one of these songs. I wish he played that more. But of course, I think that ship sailed, but it is a mystery that it wasn't done more. And hey, it also included tour debuts of Something in the Night and Sherry Darling, a great incident.
One other thing to mention from around this time, Cincinnati marked the start of 18 consecutive shows with a different opener. Now, they headed out to the West Coast after Columbus, and it was pretty remarkable because he was obviously doing it on purpose. There's no question about it, especially as we move on here. There were some songs that open shows that really have never been used as an opener, and I don't think they've been used again. A perfect example, after Portland, they went to Seattle, and the show in Seattle opened with Trapped. That is the first and only time Trapped has opened a show, right?
I believe so. That was pretty cool. That's actually a really, really interesting opener because it starts so, it doesn't explode. It's kind of a slow burn until the first chorus.
I can't remember. I think that Eddie Vedder may have had something to do with that. He was at that show and he lives in Seattle. And I think he may have requested Trapped. I remember hearing that story somewhere way back when. But you're right. It's a really interesting and unusual opener.
I really like it. Because of that slow burn, it has a different feel. And it's the release is actually almost bigger than had he just come crashing in with, say, Out in the Street.
Man, if you think about it from the standpoint of the narrative, which we spent a lot of time talking about in the last episode, opening with Trapped and going into Is There Anybody Alive Out There, Radio Nowhere, really puts a different spin on things.
That's true. But from a momentum point of view, that's a hell of a segue.
And also in that show, The Promised Land was followed by Waiting on a Sunny Day. That's pretty normal. But then Your Own Worst Enemy, Into Point Blank, Into Devil's Arcade. So I don't know, maybe he was in a dark mood that night. That's pretty bleak.
Yeah, it is. And but hey, coming out of Sunny Day, I guess, with the crowd getting into it, I guess, maybe not the people, the hardcores in the pit, but rest of the audience really into it. Well, we got to talk about the next show in Vancouver on March 31st. If only because the tour debut of our podcast namesake.
Yes. That was the first performance ever with the full E Street Band, right?
Yes, you are correct, sir.
Because it had been played at the Christmas shows.
Yeah, so this was the first time it was actually just done with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. And I think, well, wasn't that an Eddie Vedder request?
Was he also in Vancouver?
Somebody
requested it. It's very close to Seattle.
Somebody requested it out of that Seattle music scene. Maybe it wasn't Eddie, but it might have been somebody else, and I wish I could remember, but I don't.
Well, it was very cool that he played that. Unfortunately, I wasn't in Vancouver. That we heard that was a hot show.
Yes, it was. And I remember that was Jim's tried to do a they were trying to do some interesting stuff with audio bootlegs at the time. They were actually taking the 2496 audio and putting them onto DVDs and making that instead of playing it on your CD player, you have to play it on your DVD player. And not really, it didn't really catch on, but I gotta say it, that extra bandwidth in the audio, certainly it really filled the room. It was really cool how it felt.
That does sound cool. I don't think I ever heard those.
They were cool. I don't know if they tried it anywhere else.
After Vancouver, they moved down here to California, and this was a great week in California with one of the shows really standing out. He started in Sacramento, and the show opened with Spirit of the Night, continuing the different openers. That also, and this was really strange at the time, Spirit of the Night was played because it won a pick the song contest from the local radio station. And when that started, we were like, what? Since when does he do stuff like that? But Spirit of the Night won, and it opened the show, and it was a great opener.
Yeah, he did that at a few shows during that stretch, and it was weird because very few fans, at least that I knew, even knew about it. It was one of these things where, like, who chose the songs, and how do they even publicize it? But they did it the next night in San Jose, and Fire won. That's kind of a decent
choice. That was a welcome thing to see. That San Jose show was a really hot show, and of course, there's a phenomenal IEM from Hoserama.
Yeah, he did an amazing job. He recorded it and mixed it, and of course, Crystal Cat stole it, but whatever. Crystal Cat really did a lot of work on this tour, not always their best work, but they put out a lot of releases from that tour.
And then we arrived in Anaheim, and April 7th is a key show. It obviously altered the history of the E Street Band because a certain guest from this night would recur very often and later become a regular member in the future, at least for a regular member for a short period of time. And that, of course, is Tom Morello. This was a show. We were outside. We heard the sound check that they were rehearsing an electric version of Ghost of Tom Joad. It sounded insane. And this was a really, really hot show with, again, an unusual opener, Light of Day, to open the show. Fabulous.
Only other shows I can think of that he opened with Light of Day were like those Stone Pony gigs in 87.
It was highly effective. And speaking, this was a show where, even though he made some changes, a hard-biting show, Light of Day into Radio Nowhere. Magic was bookended by Trapped and Murder Incorporated. I really thought those worked well together. And from there, the set sort of settled into the typical structure until he introduced Morello. And really what followed was quite the moment. I think the entire crowd was stunned. It was unlike anything we'd ever seen at a Springsteen show. Of course, he had never done Joad before with the band. And Morello's playing just sent the crowd into a frenzy. It was pretty remarkable. And of course, we all know that because it was later released as part of the Magic Tour highlights.
Right. I was excited just to hear about it because I remember in 98 that they were trying to get a version of Ghost of Tom Joad with the E Street Band together for tracks. So it was like 10 years later, they're finally getting it. And then to hear what Morello did on guitar, that just took it, you know, way over the top. And it was just tremendous. And I can't imagine what it would have been like just to see that for the first time and to see them gelling and to hear Morello's guitar or theatrics or whatever you want to call it, almost like pyrotechnics, just going to town.
Totally insane. And let me just say, it wasn't just the crowd. The look on the faces of the E Street Band, including Bruce, when that was going on, it was they were on another level. And it was one of those crazy, it only happens once moments. I know they've repeated the Ghost of Tom Joad many, many times, and Morello was great. But that single performance was one of the best performances of the tour. It was just off the charts.
Right. So they made a good call, including that one on the Magic Tour Highlights EP. That's for sure.
I think they knew what they had there. Yes.
Well, and then, I mean, didn't I hear rumors that they actually used some of that recording for the studio track on High Hopes? Or am I making that up?
Oh, that I have not heard, but you have better sources on those things than I do.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I think I heard, but it's hard to pick out. And it took them 5 years to get it, I guess, to get a recording of it in the studio, but it's worth it.
And leading into the 5-pack of Devil's Arcade, The Rising, Last to Die, Long Walk Home, and The Badlands, that was, it certainly elevated it. It was already working extremely well, as we talked about last time, but this elevated it into another sector altogether. This was one hell of a show. That's all I have to say.
All right. And then the second night, come back, more Morello.
Interesting, because the second night there was going to be more Morello. Bruce seemed to have lost track of the show the second night, because if you notice, Joe has played again, but what's missing after it? It's the first time that Devil's Arcade has dropped, and also The Rising has dropped for the first time ever.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That was very notable. And as the show was going on, I do recall we were talking about it, that the show was running very, very long, because he included both Prove It and Because the Night, which generally had been switching off. Then he did She's the One. And even after Promised Land, he did Brilliant Disguise. Then he brought out Morello. I don't know if it was a time thing, if he planned to jettison Devil's Arcade and The Rising. I will say it was not. The handwritten set list is on Bruce Bass, as it turns out. And yes, Devil's Arcade is not on there, but The Rising was.
Right. So that actually be kind of foreshadowed what was going to be happening later, a few weeks later, a few months later, however you want to describe Europe, where he would have more of a, like, I don't want to say a classic, but certainly an epic, like such as Incident or Racing in the Street or Backstreets in place of Devil's Arcade. I guess in European stadiums, Devil's Arcade might not have worked too well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Devil's Arcade was not going to work in European stadiums. But The Rising being skipped was a real shocker. Of course, it had never been skipped at that point.
And yeah, even on Devils and Dust, it hadn't been skipped.
Yeah, it was really, when you know a song is going to be played in a specific slot, suddenly when it's skipped, it's really quite jarring. Now, I think you and I are generally in favor, except for maybe Born to Run. There's no song that we feel needs to be played every night, but he had constructed this set very specifically, and The Rising was a key part of it. So the fact that it was not there definitely was a change.
Well, I had a question I wanted to ask here. How was the segue from Tom Joad to Last to Die? I mean, usually he just slams right into Last to Die out of The Rising. How did it work here?
I happened to check this out earlier today because I hadn't heard it in a while. It's not a good recording, by the way. But at the end of Joad, he counted down, and he did smash directly into Last to Die.
All right, so it served like The Rising.
Yes, it did.
After Anaheim, they head down to Texas for a couple shows, and I think that the show in Houston deserves a little discussion, if just because Terry Song, the world debut, the live debut of Terry Song, and then he has a couple of friends. Alejandro Escovedo came out for Always a Friend, and then Joe Ely came out with All Just to Get to You. And Always a Friend, another release of the Magic Tour Highlights EP.
Yeah, which was only 4 songs. It was, yeah, 4 songs. Make that thing like 10 or 12 songs at the very minimum, I don't know.
It should have been, I think 2 of them were covers. So, yeah, kind of an odd little release. But it was cool to see and hear the Always a Friend with the E Street Band, with Alejandro leading them through the song.
So the Houston show was on April 14th, and unfortunately on April 17th, as we all know, Danny Federici lost his battle with cancer and passed away. That led to several shows being postponed while the band regrouped and they held the funeral. The funeral was in Red Bank, and Bruce performed. I did other people perform as well?
I don't know. He delivered a eulogy, though, in addition to the 3 songs.
Bruce performed Sandy, Across the Border, and If I Should Fall Behind, 3 unbelievably appropriate songs.
So then the tour was resuming in Tampa, and to say this was going to be one of the most emotional shows of the band's career would be an understatement. They had certainly other nights have been emotional, thinking back to the Lennon show in 1980 and even the last night of the reunion tour, but nothing was going to be like this.
Very emotional night. Sorry that I was not there, but it just wasn't something that was meant to be. And for everyone who was there, that was just what was described, just pure emotion. The show opened with a tribute video to Danny, and then Backstreets with the organ position empty and a light shining down on the organ. Just really a beautiful tribute.
And there was no organ, so you really had a feeling, got a sense of what was missing when Danny wasn't on that stage.
And this show, of course, is also an archive release.
And it's actually a really interesting show. It's almost an E Street retrospective, because there was at least one song from every E Street album, 73 to 87. They even had Brilliant Disguise in there.
For all our talk about the narrative, and it certainly was there in 2007, starting with this show in Tampa, really the narrative of the Magic Tour changed. He still was doing the stuff about the country, but the show became much more about the band and camaraderie and what they had lost. And that really played out, especially over these next few weeks here, right after Danny's funeral. Bruce told long stories about Danny from the early days, and he clearly was very impacted, as you would expect, by Danny's loss. And it was the first time they'd ever really experienced anything like this. Of course, Danny was the first E Street band member who unfortunately passed away. And I think what Bruce did here, and you tell me your thoughts, with the way he tailored the show from this point on, especially for these next few weeks, it was really effective.
Well, the first thing he did was Magic got dropped. So that fits in with what you're saying about he got away from he was moving away from the narrative that he had created in 2007 and early 2008. Living the Future was still there, and most of the five pack that ended the main set were still there. Devil's Arcade got dropped, even more often than not, actually, from this point forward. And even at the show in Tampa, he did Racing in the Street in that spot, which worked really well. But as you were saying, he said he'd going back into the box and pulling stuff out. And this performance of Sandy without Danny, and then they did Growing Up with that beautiful story about looking over the hill at his funeral, after his funeral, was very touching. But it was the fact that he was focusing on the band and of what they meant, the music that they made together through all those years. And that became the focus for the rest of the tour.
Certainly the rest of this leg in particular, and the next show in Orlando opened with the first ever rock performance of Blood Brothers.
First ever and only.
Yes. Could also, of course, we're going to say this a lot, and we said this the last time, release the entire Magic Tour, because so many of these shows are really special. And I think Orlando, I wasn't there and you weren't there, but from everything we heard, this was a very special show. The Blood Brothers opening, the story about Danny prior to Does This Bus Stop? And then you got a Roger McGuinn guest appearance, which is pretty damn cool, in the encores.
Right. And then, okay, I'm forgetting here. Which one of these songs was included on the Magic Tour highlights?
Turn.
Okay. I couldn't remember. But yeah, that was a pretty nice little combo. And I'm sure that Bruce and Steve were both on Cloud Nine. Actually, the whole E Street band was probably on Cloud Nine as they played it.
That is some sweet rock and roll, those two songs. Turn, and Mr. Tambourine Man, Roger McGuinn fronting Bruce and the E Street Band. That is really, really good.
And then they moved up to Atlanta, and they were sticking with this theme of early tour debuts that they brought out, Blinded by the Light in Atlanta, Wild Billies in Charlotte. So they were he was really going back to the old days with a lot of Danny emphasis. And as you said, telling the stories, you know, Danny and the giant marijuana plant, and then Danny taking the buttons off the elevator in the hotel. Danny was a very interesting character.
Yes, he was. Those stories are pretty funny when Bruce tells them, and they clearly, well, they didn't call him the Phantom for nothing. I mean, he was a character.
That's true. In Charlotte, in addition to Wild Billy's, they got the tour debut of Souls of the Departed to open it. And that's kind of a different take on Danny's passing. This is a prayer for the souls of the departed, and definitely different than what he had been saying otherwise.
And again, continuing that run every show with a different opener. Some of these, the next show opened with Roulette into Don't Look Back. It really crazy that he did that, thinking back on it, because there's obviously no period in his career where he's even come close. Even at the 15 nights at the Meadowlands, he didn't come close to opening every night with a different song.
Not at all. I mean, the first 6 nights alternated between 2 songs.
Were you at any of these shows?
Yes, we were in Charlotte, Greensboro, and Charlottesville. That Greensboro show was really hot. Obviously, it's been released as an archive, and so people could hear it. That was one of the disappointing things about that show, was that there wasn't a great tape. And open with Roulette into Don't Look Back, I mean, that's a boom, boom, boom. And then Radio Nowhere, they make the third boom. And then we were actually kind of pretty excited to hear Mary's Place. It was a tour debut, and it was fun to hear it not bloated out to 18 minutes.
Yes, we don't want the bloat of Mary's Place. And a very effective song when it is the 5 or 6 minute compact rock version.
Right, exactly. I think, though I think it was still like 7 or 8 minutes. But now you want to hear something very frustrating about the Greensboro show, Hal?
Sure.
Well, you'd live by the sign, you die by the sign. So some kid had a sign for Sunny Day, so he plays it after Mary's Place. You want to know what was on the handwritten set list for that spot?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
None But the Brave.
That's an ouch.
Yeah, that was a big ouch. But oh well. Oh well, it happens. I think Streets of Fire was actually set listed at in Charlotte. So yeah, it happens all the time. And then we moved up to Charlottesville, and I'm going to annoy some people, but this was not a good show. They were...
Okay.
They came out, our friend Paul put it this way. They had been going on such emotion for, you know, over a week and a half. And I think by the time they got to Charlottesville, they just came out flat. It opened with Loose Ends, and it was pretty much, I mean, it was just flat for the rest of the night. It was just one of those shows where there was something missing. And if you hadn't seen a lot of shows of Bruce and the band, you probably didn't notice it. But yeah, we walked out of that one going, yeah, okay, fine. All right, well, let's look ahead to the next one, which for us wasn't until July.
And the leg ended in Sunrise. The most notable thing about that show is my nemesis song, I Want to Be With You, was played as the second song of the night after Promised Land opened, completing the 18th and final show with a different opener. The next show, which would be the first show in Europe, also opened with Promised Land breaking that string. But I Want to Be With You played, of course, that song I have not seen that I really would like to see. You said you had stopped at Charlottesville, so you were not in Florida.
Right. The Sunrise show on May 2nd was rescheduled from...
Right. Because of the funeral.
Right, from April 18th. So we were actually, I mean, our plan was to have seen the last 3 shows of the leg ending in Charlottesville. So we were not going to fly back down to Sunrise. We had a good time. It's always fun to have to follow a tour for consecutive cities and then have a night off and be able to relax one night and then before seeing the next show. Look back on that with a lot of fond memories.
Wait a sec. Didn't you just say you didn't see another show again until July?
Yeah, I did say that. And now as I'm scrolling here, I realize that's not true.
There was one more show in the U.S. before Europe, not part of the tour. I unfortunately did not see this one. You did.
Yes.
It took place at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, a very special show. And they did something there for the first time. Tell us about the show.
Yes, it was the first time they did complete albums. They did Darkness to start. They took a little break and came out and did Born to Run. I was less than thrilled with the idea of them doing albums. I thought it was kind of lazy. I still kind of do. But it worked. They were in the Basie. We had amazing seats, actually. And what worked really well was the encores, where he did So Young and In Love and Kitty's Back, which, yes, I'm saying I liked it. And Rosie and Raise Your Hand. All of them had the horn. So I think that took it up a notch. And then on Born to Run on 10th Avenue, you had the horns, obviously. And then Meeting Across the River with Mark Pender providing the trumpet, that was something special.
Yeah, as we've discussed before, I'm not the hugest fan of complete albums played at these shows either, but this was a special event, and it must have been really cool to be in that theater and to see those songs. I mean, all in one night, you saw in the Count Basie Theater, Racing in the Street, Backstreets, Jungleland, yes. Rosalita. How could that be anything other than mind-blowing?
Yeah, and I went in with less than high expectations, but I was blown away by it. I had a great time in the end, especially, as I said, the encores with all the horns, and I loved it. Looking back, I love it. I just wished it was a better recording of it, but maybe one day through the archive series, they'll pull that one out.
Now, I thought what he said was funny. It was the reason why he played Darkness first was because he didn't want people to leave and kill themselves or something
yes.
like that.
Yes, to start with the darker stuff and then come back with more of the fun Born to Run. And yeah, and it was funny, they even messed up the intro of Badlands, the very first song of the night. They were so used to doing it coming out of another song, which they had done basically on the previous, well, including the Magic Tour and the Rising Tour and the Reunion Tour. They had done it coming out of something else every single time. So they weren't used to doing it cold. So that was different.
Well, it just sounds like a great night. Perhaps one day they'll release that as well. they really should just release everything from 2008. They have it.
Hey, well, let's not stop there. Let's say every night from 12 and 13 and 7. So let's just go nuts.
Now, I think let's wrap up here. Bruce did a performance at the Stone Pony for the Rainey School, which he was doing around that time. Then he also made a guest appearance at the Pony on the 17th with Mike Ness.
Yes, we missed it by 20 minutes. We hustled down there. We thought it was one of these late night pony shows. It turns out it was more of a regular time, and we got there at 10:30, and they left the stage at like 10. So, and I love the songs that they did together. Misery Loves Company. I love that song. Ball and Chain. I Fought the Law. Man, that would have been a hell of a thing to see. And there's no recording of it. Not that I would have recorded it, but there's no recording of it.
Well, and now let's talk about what we're going to do with our show, because we're an hour into this and we've only gotten through the first leg of the U.S. in 2008. We have a lot to cover in Europe. And of course, we have a lot to cover when they return to the U.S. Even though we were planning to do it in two parts, I think this show, if we go the whole way through to the end of 2008, this episode's going to be over 2 hours long.
Two and a half, I think. You're going to spend half an hour just on those two shows. Come on.
Yeah. So should we just break it here?
Let's just break.
Okay. So we'll break it here. The U.S. leg, the spring leg is over. We're going to come back. And next time we're going to pick back up with May 22nd in Dublin. And we're going to go straight through from the European tour into the U.S. Stadium tour, and of course the events of the U.S. Arena tour that ended in St. Louis and Kansas City, and that's going to be fun to discuss.
And then we'll wind up in Milwaukee.
Right. There was one extra show. Bruce did call the Kansas City show the finale of the Magic Tour.
So weird.
But there was one more show after that at the Harley Festival.
So weird that he called it the last show, and then they, like a week later, it's like, oh, yeah, we're playing again.
I think in his mind, he just felt like the tour was ending and that Harley was going to be a totally different type of show. But whatever. We'll discuss that next time.
All right.
So here's our wrap-up, None But the Bravest presentation of Bull Market Entertainment and a part of Evergreen Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at NBTB Podcast, on the web or at NoneButTheBravePodcast.com.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McClain saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show. Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.